The following sermon was recorded at Pipe Creek Community Church in Pipe Creek, Texas. For more information, visit our website at pipecreekcc.com. May God bless you as you study His Word.
Okay, I hope you're in Daniel chapter 3. There's a method to my madness. I was originally going to just start verse 14 and read, but it's important that you... I think people who are good interpreters of the Bible are not necessarily greatly gifted, but they ask the right questions, I think, but they're also good listeners. I think you need to be a good listener of Scripture oftentimes, and this is one of those places where I think it's especially important. You recognize and I tried to bring it out in the way that I read it, that Daniel, when he writes this, it is meant to be satire, almost. Think Monty Python. Okay? Think ridiculousness. The mindless redundancy of the way that he writes it. It's supposed to give it a comedic element. If it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. Nevertheless, that really is his goal. And just in verses 2 through 15, you see all of the offices listed 3 different times, all of the instruments listed 4 different times, a list given of all the officials, and then saying, after it gives all these officials that are there, the elites, it says, and all the officials, right? And it lists all these instruments, and then it says, and every kind of instrument. Do you see that? It's all people, nations, and languages. It's every kind of music. It is immediately and as soon as you hear the music. And it's fall down. Or burn. There's no thoughtfulness. It's robotic, tedious. It is mindless. It is over-repetitious. It is the foolishness of idolatry. It is the twilight zone, black and white. There's no color. Everybody's walking around speaking the same tone. This week I've had dinner with a family experiencing difficulty with their health. I had lunch with another family who's another man who's a same thing. He's got a wife, pregnant. She has MS. She's got twins. One of the babies isn't doing good. They're going to have to make a decision probably in the next couple of weeks. I went to memorial service yesterday of an amazing woman who lived 77 years and gave her life to teaching young people. And it was not robotic. It was real. It was difficult. It was messy. But it was authentic. There was lots of thinking and there was lots of feeling. And there was struggle. But there was faith. There was relationship with God. There was comfort, not just in prayers being said, but comfort in worshiping who He is. And fighting off the foolishness of the world. And fighting off our own depravity. And fighting off the temptation to despair. And fighting those things off, not with a stiff upper lip. But fighting those things off with truth. Truth about who God is. Who He really is. I'm going to be okay, and I know I'm going to be okay, not because I think everything is going to all of a sudden be better. Not because I spent the afternoon reading Chicken Soup for the Soul. But I know who God is. And because I know who God is, and I believe it, that's where I get the comfort I need. And that's where I get the courage I need. And that's where I get the strength that I need for tomorrow. And in this passage, you're supposed to not see any of that because there's none there except for in three Jewish slave boys who have, by the power of God, been put in leadership position. And they're standing up in a bowing world. There was a meme a few years ago. I'm not one that searches the internet for memes, okay? So don't think that about your pastor, but just happened to see it. Not that that's sinful or something, writer. But it was a picture of a group of Christians, scantily clad, huddled together in the middle of the Roman Colosseum, surrounded by lions. And underneath it, it said, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. And that irony and that sarcasm was powerful. And I don't know who did it. It may be a hater of Christianity who did it, but it was very powerful. Because it said the superficial is nonsense. The shallow, what is the shallow going to do? A superficial, shallow understanding of God is fine when everything is great. But when everything goes bad, when you're tempted to conform yourself and bow to just like the rest of the world, that stuff's not going to fly. It's going to be of no help. And so I read it that way. I read it the way I think Daniel wanted you to hear it. You're supposed to say, yell out at the pastor, stop! Summarize! Right? We got it! But you're supposed to understand the foolishness. Absolute foolishness of it all. So last week when we ended, Daniel had revealed the king's dream. Told him what it meant. And Nebuchadnezzar was on his face before Daniel, honoring the true God of the universe. He's told that the statue of gold, the head is him. And he's told that he's the most powerful man in the world right now. And he's the most powerful man in the world of the most powerful kingdom in the world because God gave him that. Because God did it. And right now he's the most powerful man in the world, but it's going to fall. It's not going to be forever. The fall is coming. And in getting the revelation of the dream and the meaning of the dream, he falls down before Daniel. He honors Daniel's God because Daniel's God is a God who is a revealing God. He's a God of revelation. And then you open in chapter 3. It's years later, most likely. And what do you find? You find Nebuchadnezzar building a golden image. It didn't take him long to go from honoring to building. Now the image itself is 90 foot tall. It's ridiculous. It's gold all the way from top to bottom. It's an echo, an embodiment of the dream that he had that was revealed to him and made known to him, the understanding. But it's all gold. None of that clay stuff at the bottom that gets it wrecked. See, his idea is I'm going to thwart God. God says this is what's going to happen. Daniel's God says this is what's going to happen. We'll see. I'm going to build a statue with gold from top to bottom. I will be the ultimate determiner of my kingdom. Thank you very much. I will decide how this thing's going to go. And I say it's going to go on forever. So that was his decision. After a great experience of the revelation of God. And so that makes this chapter ultimately about responses. It's about King Nebuchadnezzar's response to God. And about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's response to the king. And all of it is related to God and who he is. Nebuchadnezzar says, I will not bow, I will build. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, we will not bow, we'll burn. So while Nebuchadnezzar learned in chapter 2 that there is a God who reveals, in this chapter he's going to learn that there is a God who delivers. He gives revelation to his people, and he is the deliverer of his people. This is the only chapter in Daniel in which Daniel is not in it anywhere. And in verses 16 through 18, this is the only place in all of Daniel in which Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego even speak a word. So it's the book of Daniel, and there is no Daniel. And it's the only time these boys even say a word in the whole book. Why is there no Daniel in this book? Well, he's off doing things that powerful men do. I don't know what he's doing. He's out of town. He's sick. What's the purpose? The purpose is so that you don't think this book's about Daniel. That's the purpose. Daniel's not here. This is about God. This is about the sovereign power of God. This is about the glorious presence of God. It's got a chiastic structure, and I put this up. I put it in the on a slide up here behind me. I hope you see it. I want to show you this because we could do this every week because there's a chiasm in every chapter of Daniel. But real quick, you see how it sits a step, like A, B, C, and then back down B, A. And you see, so the beginning and the end mirror each other. So there's a decree and a command from the king at the beginning. And there's a decree and command from the king at the end. And then there's the king is furious, and he commands that Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego are brought to him. And then later on, the king is filled with fury and ordered that they're bound. One time they're brought, and the next time they're bound, cast into the furnace. But right there in the middle, letter C. This is what chiastic structure does. Is it like an arrow? It points you to the center of the text, the main point that the author wants you to know, and that's verses 16 through 18, right there in the middle. And this is what this is about. Now, it seems like it's about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's trust in God, and to some degree, it is. They are putting true trust in God on display. But recognize how they're doing it. Verse 15, the king says, now, if you are ready, he's going to give them a second chance. They messed up the first time. They're brought to him bound. And he says, okay, God, I'm going to give you a second chance. Now, if you're ready, when the music plays, I'm not going to say all the instruments, when the music plays, hit your face or you're going to the fire. But if you don't, you're going to the fire. So now if you are ready, let's do this. But if you don't, you're going to the fire. And then he says, and who is the God who will deliver you? That's a rhetorical question in his mind. There is no God that will deliver them. That's going to change. But notice what their answer is. And this is the point of this story. Their answer is, hands off our life. Okay? If you're ready, and if you don't, and they say, our God will, and our God is. We don't have to answer you. You're trying to make it about us, and it's about God. The king is trying to make it about an issue between the king and them, and they're saying, "You don't have. It's not about us. You have an issue with God." They're taking their hands off their life, totally trusting in God. God will answer for us. We don't answer you. Who is this? Who is the God who will deliver you? We don't have to answer you. God will answer you. Hands off their life, totally trusting in God. Verse 17, if this be so, our God is able to deliver. And we think He will. But even if He doesn't. But recognize, our God is able. He will. Our God is, He will. Not anything, it's not you, it's not me, it's not us, it's Him. It's glorious. They are totally trusting in God. This is about the presence and power of God. They're in the furnace. They're going to be in the furnace. And so are you and I from time to time. The world's attempt to bring us into submission is the furnace. To make this life sometimes a furnace. To bring the pressure and the heat down. To deploy this weapon as a means to make us bend to conformity. To make us bow. Deuteronomy 4:20, Moses refers to the Israelites' time in Egypt as an iron furnace out of which the Lord brought them. Isaiah 48, the Lord calls Babylon the furnace of affliction where His people are being refined. So there it is in Scripture, the furnace. Either a symbol of judgment or of purification. And that's true of us as well. Judgment or purification. Because of Christ, whatever fires we go through will only result in our being refined as gold, purified for the one that we live for, refined to worship the one we were meant for. This is about the power and presence of God. So as we look at it, let's look at it together. We're going to look at it in three headings, okay? Three headings. We're going to look at the problem of worship, the precision of true faith, and the power of God's deliverance, okay? Problem of worship, precision of true faith, and the power of God's deliverance. So the king has set up this image. It's a representation of Babylon and its gods. But it's really a representation of himself. Obviously, at the end of chapter 2, there is this image. We've had this image throughout chapter 2. And then we go right into chapter 3, and there's an image with all laid in gold. And we're supposed to make that connection. That's the connection that Nebuchadnezzar has made. It's really about him. And if he was trying to hide that, he lets it go in verse 15. Because he says, and who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Not who is the God who will deliver you out of the gods of Babylon's hands. My hands. That's him. That's how he sees himself. That's how he wants the world to see him. He is in the same place where the Tower of Babel was built. Building a tower to God. Trying to make a name for himself. It's a symbol of power and greatness, and in his mind, it's a symbol of permanence. Who says my kingdom will fall? It's a claim of universal sovereignty. And it's a calling to universal worship. Look, in a kingdom of many peoples and many nations and many languages, after you've gone through most of the known world and you've taken them captive, you've got people of all kinds, with all kinds of religions and all kinds of languages and all kinds of cultures. How are you going to unify that kingdom? Nebuchadnezzar puts his finger on the problem, and he's right. The problem is worship. We were made to worship. You will worship something. How can you unify a kingdom in which everybody worships something different? That's the problem. The problem is worship. And his solution is pluralism. His solution is, I'm going to build a statue, and it's a representation of me, my power, and my almighty control. And you can worship your gods in your apartments if you want to. But when you get out in public, you kneel. You privatize your faith. Nebuchadnezzar's not saying you have to worship my image instead of your God. He's saying you have to worship my image along with your God. That's what he's doing. That's what he's after. And that is what the world is after as well. Things never change. The world says, it's just, all that Christianity stuff, all that Jesus stuff, that's fine as long as you keep it inside. Don't bring it out here. Keep that private. And that's impossible for a Christian. Although we're trying really hard to do it. How do you know if you've bowed? This is how you know if you've bowed. If you profess a lot of things with your mouth and then you live like everybody else, you've bowed. That's how you know. Take a look. How's your life looking? Think of all the ways these boys could have rationalized this situation. They could have said, well, I'm not really worshiping in my heart when I bow down. They could have said, I just do it because I have to. It doesn't mean anything. Or they could have said, well, if we die, what good are we dead? If we're going to be good, if we're going to be used for God, we need to stay alive. They could have rationalized it and excused it away, but they don't do any of that. 1 John 1:5, God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. And if we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie, and the truth is not in us. If you profess truth with your mouth and then go live like you're in the darkness, you are a liar. You can't say you believe stuff in here and then it not come out there. If that's the case, you're bowing. So the problem is worship. But Nebuchadnezzar's solution is, as far as a Christian concerned, impossible. The truth of God is not just truth versus false or fact versus fiction. It is those things. It is truth that is absolute. It is truth that is ultimate truth. It's not just true as opposed to everything else that's not true. It is ultimate and absolute, meaning his truth, the truth of God, runs through everything. It affects everything. It impacts everything. If you believe God, if you believe he is true, if you believe his word is true, then it will change the way you live. It will change all your relationships. It will change all your definitions. It will change how you understand education, how you understand family, how you understand worship. It will change how you look at the sky. It will change how you handle suffering. It will change, it will change, it will change, it will change. There's no aspect of your life that the truth of God does not touch. If you try to make the truth of God, if you try to say to the truth of God, you can have this area but stay out of this area of my life, you're bowing. You're finding a way to avoid suffering. Notice that when they talk about worship here, it's fall down and worship. See, it's do something with your body and something going on in here at the same time. But that is worship. Worship is not just an inside thing, and it's not surely not just an outside thing. It's spirit and truth. It is inside and out. It is whole. It is complete. The Apostle Paul, Romans 12. I appeal to you by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your spiritual worship. And do not be conformed to the world, but transformed by the renewing of your minds. What is brought to God? Bodies are brought to God. Bodies are brought. You can be carrying the life of God inside here, but the only way it's going to glorify God if the instrument that's carrying that life goes out there and plays the Lord's song. So worship is absolutely prostrating yourself, doing something with your body as symbolic of what you do with your whole life. Absolute submission to God. But not out of nothing, not mindless. It's not a mantra. This is the truth of God I know. This is who He is. And because of who He is, I worship Him. So Christ followers, note this, Christ followers can never compromise truth for unity. Do you see it? If unity isn't true, then it's not unity. We don't compromise love either. Because if the love isn't true, it's not love. It's a horrible counterfeit. It's a fake. It's a phony. So, note, this is what's happened. Nebuchadnezzar has taken the absolute and he's made it relative. In this society, if he believes there is a God, he's going to relativize God. And so God is the same everywhere, and a whole bunch of gods, and every way is a way to God, and you privatize your faith for the sake of unity. So what is he doing? He's taking the absolute and he's relativizing it. And you can't do that because you and I were made by God with hearts that demand absolutes. If you don't have absolutes in your life, you'll destroy yourself. You'll make an absolute. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar does. Because the absolute has been relativized, he takes what is relative and he makes it an absolute. And that absolute for him is himself. And he makes an image. It's just gold. It's material. Maybe it's very, very expensive. But nobody even knows where it is now. It's dust now. But on this day, everybody but three were worshiping it. He made it absolute. And this is what we call an idol. You will make something an idol. You will make something an absolute. If God is not the absolute in your life, something will be. And whatever that is, it will destroy you or you will destroy it. Note, the mistake that he makes is he just assumes that life and death is an absolute for everybody. Worship, or I'm going to throw you in the furnace and kill you. He thinks that's going to take care of it. Because surely everybody's absolute is life. Nope. Be careful. Now, I've been blown up in roadside bombs. I've been shot at. I've run across open pavement, heard the rounds bounce off the ground. I know all about the will to live. Okay? I've run really fast. You're supposed to want to live. You won't hear me saying that. But life is not the absolute. It is not the ultimate. God is. God is ultimate. And that's where Nebuchadnezzar messes up. Because he messed up there. Turns out he's got absolutely no control over these boys. He's got no power over them whatsoever. See, he says, what God will be able to deliver you out of my hands? And these boys say, we're not in your hands. We're not in your hands. You're not in charge of life and death. Our God is. If we die, it's because it was His time for us to die. It won't be because of you. Totally, completely trusting in God. Because they know who He is. Because they know the truth. John Chrysostom, one of the greatest of the early Greek church fathers, not perfect. Some of his teaching and his theology is not exactly right, but he was a powerful preacher, fought for the poor, archbishop in Constantinople for a while. But he was a troublemaker. Called people out, especially the high and mighty. He preached sermons. He preached two-hour-long sermons sometimes. Don't worry, I'm not going to do it. He ends up being exiled. He might have been exiled for preaching two-hour sermons. I'm not sure. But ultimately, he was exiled because he made the emperor mad. And it is told that in one of his last appearances before the emperor, they're threatening him and they say to him, we will banish you from your home and the land of your father. And he says, you cannot banish me. For this world, this whole world is my father's house. And they say, okay, we're going to take away everything that you have. We're going to take away all the treasures in your life. And he says, you cannot. For my treasure is in heaven, where my heart is also. Well, we will remove you from all your friends until there's no one left. You cannot. For I have a friend that sticks closer than a brother. He's Jesus. And from Him you cannot separate me. Well, then we're going to kill you. You cannot. For my life is hid with Christ in God. There is nothing you can do to harm me. What can I fear? Death? To me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Exile? The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, and the fullness thereof. Confiscation? We brought nothing in this world, and certain we will take nothing out. O Lord, I fear not death. I desire only to live for your profit. And then he was exiled. Today he's in glory. Untouchable. These slaves have nothing but God. And that's enough. They are absolutely untouchable. Can't get to them. How about you? How about me? Where are you bowing? Right. That's the problem of worship. I'm going to go faster. The precision of true faith. So life and death is not their absolute. God is. They know that the only true God has power over life and death and not Him. They know that Nebuchadnezzar cannot keep God's will from happening or cause something outside of God's will to happen. So in verse 16, 17, and 18, they say to him, you don't have us. God has us. You need to take this up with Him. We're not answering you about this. They let God handle it. They're going to be obedient and faithful. They're going to let God handle the rest. Sounds pretty easy. It's not. It's not always easy. Not ever easy, I guess. But that's what they do. They submit to God's will for them. But notice how precise their faith is. And when I say precise, what I mean is their faith is precisely in God. Their faith is precisely in God. In other words, their faith is not determined by God doing what they think He should do. We will believe in God as long as He does this, this, and this. I will believe in God if He shows me this, this, and this. If He starts to work in my life in this way, then I will believe. That is faith in God plus these things that I really want more. Their faith is precisely in God. Notice what they say. Their obedience to God is not because of a payoff or reward they think they're going to get. They say, we know God is able to save. We think He will. But even if He doesn't, and that's where true faith is, it's in when God says no, are you still believing? Are you still trusting in God then? And then notice how it works itself out in their life. It's peaceful non-compliance, right? There's never been more mannerly boys put to death in the history of the world, right? They're so nice. Take that up with God, whatever. I mean, but there's no rallies and there's no marches and there's no protests. There's no assassinations. There's not, hey, this is an opportunity to glorify myself. They just simply won't bow. Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't even know if they weren't, some tattletales weren't there. Right? Some snitches. He wouldn't have even known. They called no attention to themselves. This is between them and God. Not about them at all. I'm not surprised that the furnace issue is not about them, because this issue is not about them. Such integrity. It's always about God. It's neither assimilation nor separation. They didn't say, well, we can't go with all those pagan officials. We can't be in the same place as all those people. They don't say that. They don't say, all those sinners. We can't go where those sinners are. They don't do that. It's just faithful presence. There they are present, absolutely faithful, refusing to bow, no compromise, glorifying God. Making it so that when things start to happen, everyone knows who gets the credit. All the glory goes to God. They go to God for the answers. They go to God to do the speaking for them. They go to God for the truth. God gets all the hope. God gets all the trust. Therefore, God gets all the glory when He delivers them. That's how it works. They don't even have, I don't even know who speaks. They speak. They're absolutely, did you notice that? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they say. I don't know how they said it in unison, or they practiced it. But they are absolutely unified in God. And please recognize, it is because their faith is precisely in God. Not in what He gives. Not in what He will do. They didn't marry God for His money. They married Him for Him. Their obedience is just because God is, because He is true. And they love Him. And that's the precision of true faith. And then finally, the power of deliverance. They're absolutely refusing to worship. They're absolutely confident that God is able to save. Their faith has nothing to do with whether or not He will. They're trusting God. They believe they're going to see His face in the fire, or they're going to see His face in glory. But either way, it's deliverance. He may deliver us out of the fire, or He might deliver us through it. But either way, deliverance is coming. How? They don't know. That's not up to them. But the power of that deliverance, the power of the knowledge that that is who God is, makes them untouchable. And it also makes them bold. They're not trying to build a little safe little life for themselves. They are not afraid to put themselves out. They're not afraid when the whole world has hit their face to stand. It's because of the power of this deliverance. And the power of this deliverance is seen in the absolute reversal. You know, when Christ dies on the cross, He begins to redeem His people and He begins to make all things new. And He throws into reverse all that the fall caused and all that the fall brought about until one of these days it's a new creation. He does the same thing in you and I. He takes our fallen natures and our depraved heart and He puts a new heart in and He starts to transform us. Starts to make us like His Son, Jesus. This is the power of deliverance. It throws into reverse. It's a complete transformation. And notice, everything that the king does is undone. Every decree is undecreed. Decreed again. Edit. Notice, they are first taken and they're bound. And they're taken and put in there real fast with all their clothes. So that they catch real fast and they're singed and they burn up real fast. We know that the fire was dangerous because the strongest men have them arrested and bound. And they open the furnace up and those men are destroyed by the fire. And while they're outside of the furnace, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are untouched. So those men who arrested them and bound them and brought them, they bowed to Nebuchadnezzar and they're burned in the fire anyway. Outside of the furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't bow. And they're safe inside the furnace. They're bound and thrown in the furnace. When Nebuchadnezzar looks in there, they're unbound. They're loosed. They fall in, they're walking. There's three, now there's four. They were commanded, thrown in, they're invited out. The decree was, if you worship any other god, if you don't worship my God, you'll be destroyed. The decree at the end is, if you say anything bad about their God, I'm going to destroy you. But most glorious, I think. Verse 23. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. See that word fell? It's the same word that's used when Nebuchadnezzar makes a decree and says, you must fall down and worship. In other words, the falling in was their act of worship to the true God. They didn't fall out there so that they could fall in there. And that was worship. That was worship. In the end, the king says, who is the God who can deliver you? And at the end he says, no other God can deliver in this way. Now you might think I'm going to point to the fourth person in the fiery furnace and say that's Jesus. I believe it is. Absolutely, I do. He went through the most horrible fire, the fire of God's wrath, so that no matter what fire you and I go through, we'll be safe. so that every fire from now on will not be a judgment of condemnation, but will be refinement and purification, so that we can become more like Him and worship Him. But I want to point to Christ in a different place. 9 different times it's repeated that the king set up the image on the plain. He sets it up so that everybody can stand before it and bow. He set it up. He set it up. He set it up. He set it up. And then Christ in John chapter 12 says, "Now is the time for the world to be judged. And when I am lifted up, when I am lifted up, I will bring the world to myself." The constructed idol image of Nebuchadnezzar set up to be worshipped is replaced with the cross. Lifted up, Christ is, on a small hill called Calvary. And we stand before it. We don't worship it because of the gold. Something far more valuable there. It's a death of a perfect life in our place, given for us. Notice the deliverance. He doesn't save them from the fire. He saves them through it. That's salvation throughout the Bible. Noah and his family are not saved out of the rain. They're in an ark, covered in the storm. They're delivered through the storm, not from it. The people of God are delivered through the Red Sea, not around it. And Christ delivered us by walking through sin and death, coming out on the other side. This is a deliverance that has power beyond our imagination. We should access it. We should live in light of it. We should give our lives for it. That's what we're called to do. This kind of belief doesn't happen unless you believe in the sovereignty of God and you believe that God is for you. Do you believe that God is for you? The only way you can know that God is for you is if you know Christ. Put your faith in Him.